We'll hear argument first this morning in number 8759, United States Postal Service versus National Association of Letter Carriers. Mr. Nager, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This case comes to the Court on a writ of certiorari from the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. That Court held that the Postal Service must comply with an arbitration award that orders it to reinstate to a letter carrier position an individual who has been criminally convicted of failing to deliver over 3,500 pieces of mail and who an arbitrator found posed a risk of again delaying the mail in the future. We have sought review by this Court because we believe that the Postal Service cannot comply with the decision below without defaulting upon its statutory obligations to ensure that the mail is reliably delivered. The facts of the case are relatively simple. In June of 1984, postal inspectors made a lawful search of the personal automobile of the grievant, in this case, Mr. Edward Hyde. In the course of that search, they found over 3,500 pieces of mail in the back seat of the car. Some of the mail contained United States Treasury checks, and some of those checks were dated April 1, 1983, indicating that the mail had been delayed. Some of the pieces of the mail had been delayed at least a year and a half. The Postal Service immediately had Mr. Hyde arrested and charged him with unlawful possession and unlawful delay of the mails in violation of 18 U.S.C.
May I ask a factual question, Mr. Nager? What is the normal, how much mail would he normally carry in a day? This isn't a year and a half's accumulation of mail, obviously, 3,500 pieces. Would that be a couple of days' mail or what?
Justice Stevens, I really don't know the answer to that. His route was in Long Island, New York, in Jericho, New York, and I really don't know how many houses that covered.
Kind of hard to understand how mail that old could be. He must have delivered some of it since that period. You don't.
I think that's probably right, but the record doesn't reflect that. I just don't know.
Was any of that junk mail, or was it all good mail? I mean, if it was junk mail, it might not.
The U.S. Treasury checks, I doubt, were junk mail. The Postal Service charged Mr. Hyde with unlawful possession of the mail and unlawful delay of the mail. He pled guilty to the latter offense and was sentenced to 18 months probation, a condition of which was that he enter and complete a rehabilitation program for compulsive gamblers. Now, because of his criminal dereliction of duties, the Postal Service sought to discharge Mr. Hyde. The respondent, the National Association of Letter Carriers, filed a grievance on Mr. Hyde's behalf under the collective bargaining agreement that the Postal Service and the letter carriers have entered into. And they argued that the Postal Service was without just cause to discharge Mr. Hyde and that he should be reinstated to his letter carrier position.
Mr. Nager, I take it there's been a stay entered, so this employee has not been back on the job?
Yes, Justice O'Connor. The Solicitor General sought a stay from the Chief Justice of the D.C. Circuit's mandate.
And the case is not moot because the employee still wants to return to being a letter carrier?
Yes, that's right. And in addition, I'm sure that the union would file a grievance seeking a back pay from the date of which the Postal Service is supposed to start complying with the arbitration order.
Mr. Nager, what's the connection between compulsive gambling on the one hand and not delivering mail on the other?
Justice Blackmun, the record doesn't reflect it. I've speculated on it, but the arbitrator found that his failure to deliver the mail was attributable to his compulsive gambling problem. He didn't say how it led to his failure to deliver the mail, and the Postal Service's collective bargaining agreement with the letter carriers does not provide, and in fact prohibits, the use of transcripts during the arbitral proceedings, so there's no record of testimony on that point.
A little easier to understand if it were alcoholism, but there's no accusation here, certainly no conviction of stealing government checks, is there?
No, he pled guilty to unlawful delay. He was charged with unlawful possession. He was not charged with stealing the mail. Now, an arbitrator convened a hearing with respect to the grievance and ruled in respondent's favor for Mr. Hyde. The arbitrator found that Mr. Hyde had, in fact, unlawfully delayed the mails, but he also found that it was attributable to what he characterized as a grievance, a mental disease, his affliction for compulsive gambling. He thus saw his own task as what he termed balancing the needs of society, the needs of the mentally ill, and the needs of the employee, and he identified as the differentiating factor in that balance what he called, and I quote, the possibility of rehabilitation, end quote. He then found that he didn't know what the future prospects of rehabilitation were for Mr. Hyde, and indeed this was a tough decision for him because he saw that there was a threat of recurrence of the misconduct. But in that balance, where there was a possibility of rehabilitation, he concluded that this is not a risk-free society, and thus it is the Postal Service and the Postal Service's patrons who should bear the risk of that future misconduct while there was a reasonable hope of rehabilitation for Mr. Hyde.
Well, thus, Mr. Nager, there's in this case, there is a statute that provides that delivery of the mail is the highest priority of the Postal Service. On the other hand, there are statutes saying the Postal Service will engage in collective bargaining, and there are statutes reflecting that rehabilitation is also appropriate for the employer to consider. Now, is it only where there is a statute that says one has the highest priority that it would be justifiable then to rely on that as the public policy?
I think it's clearly the case where Congress has indicated what the highest priority is among several competing statutes, that the statute Congress indicated has the highest priority should prevail.
And if there weren't such language?
If there weren't such language, I think the court would, and as it does in every case in which it's faced with statutes that point in
with
the
competing public policies.
Correct. In cases in which there were competing public policies, the court would have to reconcile those statutes as it does in any case where there are statutes that point in different directions. That, of course, is not this case.
Mr. Nager, labor arbitration has a high priority, too, doesn't it?
It does, Justice Brennan, and we've tried to make as clear as we can in our brief that we are not seeking to in any way destabilize the labor arbitration process. The Postal Service is committed to its labor arbitration process. Last year, for example, it had 45,000 grievances, 7,500 of which
went. You are arguing for a public policy exception.
Yes, as this court has recognized, and it's we believe that
it's been recognized, but to be kept within very narrow limits, isn't it?
That's correct. But let me address why it is so important that the court not only recognize it, that it pay attention to the public policy exception. The argument in this case is that somehow allowing a public law to trump an arbitration decision will somehow destabilize the arbitration process. But quite the opposite is true. The court has to remember how collective bargaining agreements are negotiated and how arbitration provisions get put into collective bargaining agreements. Typically, in a collective bargaining context, an employer and a union will have approximately 90 days upon which to agree. If an agreement is about to expire, they'll give notice 90 days before the expiration of the agreement, and the union will come forward with a series of demands on numerous topics that they would like the employer to agree to. And the employer will respond to those demands. And over the course of 90 days, they will deal with provisions dealing with the various economics of their relationships, the various work rules that govern their relationships. Every one of those proposals can and oftentimes do have legal ambiguities in them. And the fact of the matter is that if the parties had to resolve every legal ambiguity, just as they had to resolve every contractual ambiguity before they entered into the contract, they'd never be able to enter into a contract in the first place. The public policy exception simply greases the wheel, so to speak, of the collective bargaining process. It allows the parties to reach agreement on general contract language like a just cause provision, and if that language is subsequently interpreted in a way that one or the other party thinks it would put them in violation of public law if they had to comply with it, they have the freedom to go to federal court and to seek to have that provision declared unlawful. This court's decision in Kaiser Steel versus Mullins, where the United Mine Workers and the steel company had agreed to contribute to the UMW's pension plans for every ton of coal that a non-UMW steel producer sold to Kaiser, Kaiser entered into that agreement, and in fact it had filed unfair labor practice charges with respect to an identical provision under previous agreements. It agreed to the provision, and then it refused to contribute.
Well, Mr. Nager, I don't think your opposition challenges the existence of a public policy exception. The real question is does the public policy exception warrant overturning the particular arbitrator's decision in this case?
Well, I think that's correct, Justice White, and let me turn to that. I was just trying to address Justice Brennan's question about why the public policy exception existed and how broad or narrow it should be. Before you
get to that, because this is brought to my mind by your reference to the Kaiser case, do you dispute the fact that if we didn't have a public policy problem in the case, that the arbitrator's award would be one that he would be a permissible reading of the collective bargaining agreement?
We have not disputed that in this case.
So that the case that we have to decide is one in which we could assume for arguendo that the parties had spelled out that if this particular problem should arise in the future, this solution will be given. This will be the solution. Then we say, would that contractual provision be against the public policy?
That is correct. I think we've tried to brief the case that way. We said, by hypothesis, we assume we have agreed to this provision. And the question is whether or not our statutory obligations preclude us from complying with it. And the reason why I say that hypothesis is both a realistic one is not just because of the contract and the reasonableness or unreasonableness of the arbitrator's award, because that is the nature of collective bargaining and the types of situations that employers and unions find themselves in, having to agree to ambiguous or unambiguous provisions on the recognition that either one of them can subsequently go to court and point out that provision is inconsistent with public law, because the employer, it may not be important to the employer, even if it's illegal, and it may be very important to the union, and the employer doesn't want to end up having a strike over whether or not the provision is legal or illegal.
Well, do I understand from what you say that it would have been illegal for the Postal Department to have complied with this arbitration award?
That is absolutely correct, Justice White, and let me turn to why that is the case.
Before you do, it really might help both the employer and the union in those situations, as well as help the courts, if we made it pretty clear, as I thought we had done in MISCO, what the lines are, so that the employer will very well know when he concedes something like this what he's getting himself into. Don't you think that would be helpful? I mean, you're not urging us that just because employers typically throw in the towel and say, well, you know, I'll fight that when it comes, we have to decide these things case by case forever.
No,
I thought we just had a case that's very much like this.
Well, we think it's fundamentally different from this case, but to answer your question, we do think clear rules would be helpful to everyone. We're saying the MISCO analysis applies in full force if there is a well-defined and dominant public policy and existing law and legal precedent, which is the standard the court used in MISCO, and if the arbitration award compromises or conflicts with that well-defined and dominant public policy, then the award is unenforceable. That's the legal standards that we're asking for. The question in this case, as Justice White has asked, is what is the public policy and how does it conflict? And the public policy in this case, we would submit, which the respondents have conceded, is the public's interest and Congress's mandate that the mails be maintained secure and reliably delivered. I think it goes without saying that it is a fundamental premise of our entire economic and political system that the mails will be reliably and securely delivered. The right to establish a post office and maintain it is recognized in the Constitution. The government every day relies on the sanctity and integrity of the mails to ensure that the taxes are collected, that benefit checks are delivered to the needy. Businesses rely on the mail, the sanctity and integrity of the mails every day to ensure that their business transactions are timely conducted. And the courts rely on the sanctity and integrity of the mails to ensure the safe conduct of judicial business. And in recognition of that public interest, Congress has enacted a series of statutes, the first of which grants a limited public monopoly to the Postal Service. it mandates that the Postal Service shall ensure the prompt, reliable, and efficient delivery of the mail.
Of course, that mandate, if broadly read, could certainly override anything. I mean, it delays the mail to go to arbitration. It would be more efficient to let the post office dismiss the employee on the spot. So you have to have some line drawing within the line drawing.
That's absolutely correct, Justice O'Connor, and that is why we have not suggested that the language of Section 101A of Title 39, which requires the post office to ensure a prompt, reliable, and efficient delivery of the mail, by itself establishes not only the public policy, which it does, but also the dominance and definition that this Court in Grace and in MISCA said was necessary. The definition and the dominance, we say, come from Section 410B and from 18 U.S.C. 1703, which 410B makes applicable to the Postal Service and in conjunction with 101A, mandates that the Postal Service preserve the security and sanctity of mails in preventing the kinds of actions by its own employees that Mr. Hyatt engaged in this case, in the unlawful delay of the mail. We haven't argued that any award which the Postal Service thinks isolated and by itself might...
Well, how about an employee who's just slow, just not very efficient?
We don't...
He didn't steal the mail, but the employee just moves slowly.
That is an act of misfeasance by the employee, but it is not an act of statutory malfeasance. It is not something that we read the statute as prohibiting the Postal Service from tolerating. We do read the statute as prohibiting the Postal Service from tolerating the employment of an individual who it knows there is a reason to believe that that person will intentionally not delay the mail again in the future.
Well, the Court of Appeals certainly didn't think it violated any statute.
The Postal Service looked at the statute and said, the Court of Appeals said, in order for us to agree not to enforce this arbitration award, we have to find a provision in the statute which says, in its terms, the Postal Service cannot employ an individual who has committed this act or who presents a threat to the Postal Service. But that specificity has never been required by this Court. It was not required by the Court, for example, in Heard versus Hodge, where the Court read the equal
and
protection.
It wasn't required in MISCO either.
It wasn't required in MISCO. It wasn't required in Heard versus Hodge, where the
but
Court...
But I thought you said that it would have been illegal for the Postal Service to rehire this fellow.
That is how we read our own statutory obligations, to preclude us from employing an individual who...
Well, the Court of Appeals certainly rejected that notion, I think.
Well, it did, and we think incorrectly.
Yeah.
But the reason it did was because it said that there has to be specific statutory language that, in terms, precludes the reinstatement of this individual. But this Court has never... required in order to refuse to enforce an arbitration award that degree of specificity in statutory language. Take for example.
Maybe not, but haven't we required a judgment on the part of the person who's been given that call that is so outrageous that no reasonable person could come to it?
I don't.
I mean, are you arguing that the arbitrator could not possibly have thought that the chances of rehabilitation outweighed the chances of any impairment of the...
No, we're not arguing that at all. What we're arguing is that the Postal Service is not a letter carrier position of the Postal Service is not a testing ground for the arbitrator's judgments about whether or not Mr. Hyde will eventually become fully rehabilitated. What the arbitrator said in
What is the rule, then, that whenever any Postal Service employee has committed a crime involving the mails, he must be dismissed?
Unless the arbitrator makes a factual finding based on evidence presented at the arbitration hearing that he finds that there is not a risk that the misconduct will occur again in the future.
No risk. Zero risk. You can't make that finding for any postal employee.
Well, when I say no risk, he does not find on the basis of the facts before him that there is a undue risk that misconduct will occur again in the future.
Well, didn't he make that finding here?
No, I don't believe...
Undue in the sense of the policy of trying to rehabilitate people.
What the arbitrator said in this case was he found the risk What he said is, well, I think if you keep him off the employment for another 60 days and he shows some initial commitment to rehabilitating himself, that you should assume the risk that he will commit misconduct in the future. Let me give you, you're asking for a clear rule. Let me give you an analogy where there's a clear rule that exists. In the airline industry, under the statutes regulating the safety of the airline industry, airlines are required to maintain the highest possible degree of safety. And with respect to the alcoholics that Justice Blackmun mentioned before, the Federal Aviation Administration has said, if there is a pilot who we know is an alcoholic, we will not recertify him to fly a plane, and thus he cannot be employed to fly a plane unless there is established clinical evidence of his recovery and he's abstained from drinking for 2 years. That is the kind of evidence and finding we're suggesting that the arbitrator should be required to make a finding with respect to about a letter carrier who has committed a criminal act and failing to deliver or delaying the mail, that he won't do that again. That is the degree of safety and sanctity and integrity of the mails that we believe Congress imposed the obligation upon the Postal Service to ensure.
Well, here the arbitrator's findings, if I remember correctly, were to the effect that the arbitrator is not totally persuaded that the employee presently has the emotional ability to perform the work in an acceptable manner, and the arbitrator is not able to foretell what the future prospects of his rehabilitation may yield. And you say those findings are not sufficient.
That's correct. Those findings indicated the first one you read about, that he wasn't totally persuaded that Mr. Hyde had the present emotional stability to perform the job, is why he didn't put Mr. Hyde back in initially. He postponed it for 60 days. But then he didn't say at the end of 60 days, I'll reconvene and see what Mr. Hyde's mental status is. He wouldn't ask for additional evidence on whether or not Mr. Hyde was rehabilitated. He said at the end of 60 days, if he meets the following three conditions, you have to reinstate him.
Well, suppose we agreed with you. What's the remedy? Is it to remand to the arbitrator for a more appropriate remedy?
No.
Or new findings?
I don't think so, Justice O'Connor. The question before the arbitrator is, what are the facts and what does the contract provide? He found the facts, and he also found what the contract provided. He found that the contractually appropriate remedy was reinstatement to a letter carrier position at the end of 60 days. This court, that is the question, whether or not that interpretation of the contract, as Justice Stevens hypothesized, that we assume the Postal Service agreed to, is against public policy. There is no need for remand.
It just seems to me that your rule is going to really displace the arbitrator's judgment in most cases of discharge for wrongful acts. An employee fights a lot. He's often late. He's an alcoholic. We're just not used to make finding that there's a zero risk or an insignificant risk that this will reoccur. And clinical psychologists certainly won't make that finding with reference to alcoholics. You have a two-year period like we do for pilots.
Justice Kennedy, let me make two comments. With respect to your first point about what other kinds of cases would come in within the rule that we're talking about, you have to, again, distinguish between acts of misfeasance and statutory malfeasance. Here we see that Congress has prohibited, through criminal sanction and definition, particular acts that postal and service employees shall not engage in.
What was your answer with respect to the question about theft from the mails?
Theft from the mail is statutorily prohibited, and unless there is a finding that the individual won't do it again, we believe we are not statutorily.
My point is, realistically, that finding simply can't be made, can it?
I don't dispute the difficulty of making clinical judgments, Justice Kennedy. On the other hand, the Postal Service makes them in its initial discharge decisions. The arbitrator makes them in cases where the arbitrator is entitled to do it, and where there's been no arbitrator appointed in contractual disputes about the propriety of discharge, courts have to make them. Somebody's got to make them. The question is for this court to decide, and our argument is that Congress has said for this small class of cases, The courts have the final say on whether or not the risk is undue. The arbitrator has the final say on whether or not there is, in fact, that risk. But someone's got to make the initial call as to whether there is, in fact, that risk. And then someone else, maybe the arbitrator, maybe the Postal Service, and then the courts, and we say it's the Postal Service, and then the courts, has to make the decision about whether it's undue. But the fact that it's difficult to make those findings doesn't relieve anyone of the obligation of having to make them, because the Postal Service has to make them initially, and when they go to arbitration, the arbitrator still has to make them.
Well, I thought you had agreed that the arbitrator would make decisions like this.
We have agreed that the arbitrator would make the decision as to whether or not there is a future risk. Once he defines what he believes the future risk to be, then we say it's up to the Postal Service in the first instance, but ultimately to the courts, as this court said in Misko and W.R. Grace, as to whether or not the risk is undue.
I know, but you left it to him to decide whether there was cause for the discharge.
That's correct.
That's not only making these findings, but deciding whether, construing the word cause in the contract.
That's correct.
And that's his job, and he did it.
That's correct. He did. We are not disputing that he misinterpreted the contract. What we're saying is he found that there was a risk, and he also found that there were offsetting mitigating factors. He found the fact that Mr. Hyde's father had died the year before, the fact that his brother had come close to nearly dying, the fact that he'd had cancer the year before, and above all else, he found that he was a compulsive gambler. But if the risk he found is one that is the Postal Service is statutorily not permitted to incur, which is what we suggest here, then we suggest it's up to a court to vacate that arbitration award, even though the arbitrator correctly interpreted the contract.
Would you be here if he hadn't been a compulsive gambler, but he had just been, he just was negligent. He just was a lousy Postal Service man.
If he had just been a negligent or lousy Postal Service employee, he wouldn't have met what we consider to be the threshold standard for these cases, is that he have engaged in conduct that would have put him in violation of 18 U.S. 1703, and that there wouldn't be a risk of him.
Well, he certainly would have had these 3,500 letters undelivered, which would have been a crime.
Not if you were just negligent in doing so. Again,
if there's any findings in this case that there was any causal connection between his gambling and the non-delivery.
That's what the arbitrator found. The arbitrator said that there was a causal connection. We don't know what it was, but he found it. We're bound by the arbitrator's findings. There's nothing that we can do about them. And that is, in fact, Justice White, the important point here, is that the Postal Service is bound by the arbitrator's findings. Given those findings, it is told
you're
that
bound
it hasn't
by some of them, and you don't want to be bound by some others.
No, well, we think we're bound by all of them.
Those findings, you couldn't put him in a job where he couldn't steal mail. You really say that there is no way that you can accept his findings without violating the law?
That's
I cannot believe that it's a big operation, the Post Office.
There isn't some place
you could put this man who had been there for 30 years with a clean record before this happened.
We are not suggesting that if the letter carriers in their grievance had said he did it, but he's got a problem, would you put him in another job where he doesn't have access to the mails, that if the arbitrator found that that was contractually appropriate, that would put us in violation of our statutory mandate. But
prevent that?
His order says reinstatement, and reinstatement in the ordinary English language means put the person where he was before. And it certainly means that in the accepted understanding in the labor relations context.
May I clear up one factual thing? We've talked about theft. This is not a theft case, is it? He didn't open any mail, did he? There's no evidence of that.
This is not a theft case. This is unlawful delay.
He just left unopened and undelivered mail in his
and did not report it back to the Postal Service that he had failed to deliver it at the end of
the day. The criminal proceeding didn't involve any theft. It was just delay.
It was a guilty plea for unlawful delay.
And did that criminal proceeding require scienter?
Does the statute require
an intent to violate?
I believe it does, although I have to confess.
My reading of it is that gross negligence would suffice for a violation.
Well, again, but if you put the term gross negligence on it, Justice Kennedy, you've got one of those statutory acts of misfeasance. Whatever the standard is under 1703, our position is that we are statutorily obliged to enforce 1703 to prevent the recurrence of violations of 1703. And if this person was identified by the arbitrator as a person who had violated 1703 and who there was a risk of him doing it again, our hands are tied. We read our statutory obligations as precluding us from reinstating.
Maybe you haven't had the opportunity to do this, but can you tell me, is this an unusual statement of mission, or does every agency have a statement that its primary mission is to perform certain functions?
But every agency.
Because it seems to me what you're saying is, as we go through the statutes, we could find this in every agency in the government. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, you will find it with respect to every employer who has statutory obligations, some of whom don't have to be agencies in government. For example, the airlines and in the airline industry that I referenced before have statutory obligations. Anytime Congress passes a statute, there may be an arbitration award out there that could be brought in conflict with that statute. Hopefully, arbitrators won't issue too many of those kinds of awards, and you won't be put in the position that we're in here today very often. But as we read the arbitrator's award and as we read the statute, that conflict exists in this case. With the Chief Justice's permission, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Nager. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Secular.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I'd like to begin by referring to one specific point that Justice Scalia raised, and that is the question of whether there's an alternative job. This arbitrator's decision requires the grievant, Mr. Hyde, to be reinstated to the payroll of the Postal Service, and that's all. At that point, the Postal Service is free to implement the full range of its managerial rights, and among those rights is to make a reasonable determination that someone is disabled for physical or psychological reasons and cannot perform the functions of his position. At that point, the Postal Service can assign a man to other duties. It can put him on medical furlough. It can require him to be examined by a psychiatrist. All those things can happen.
Well, they can happen, but I'm not sure that the union would lie down having him reinstated in some other job on the grounds that there's a risk of his repeating his conduct.
Well, Justice White, I don't think that's a fair presumption. I mean, the central premise of our labor law jurisprudence is that parties have a healthy, constructive, collective bargaining relationship. If management
well, that's
has
fine,
real...
But maybe we ought to dismiss the case as improvidently granted then.
Well, I think the point is that the risk to the security of the mails that is posed by the government doesn't exist here because, and we haven't contested, there are other things that can happen here. Whether the union grieves or not, if management is right, that will be established through the grievance procedure. This kind of procedure is something that happens every day in the Postal Service.
Doesn't reinstatement require reinstatement to that job or an equivalent one? And isn't this person a letter carrier?
Yes, this person is a letter carrier, but there are...
So he's got to go back into a letter carrier's position that's equivalent, that position or an equivalent one?
The answer is that he can be kept in the office. A lot of what the letter carrier does is in the office.
You're saying the post office can just keep him on the payroll and not give him any
duty. No, he can sort mail. He can within the office. Now, I think it's a real stretch to say that Hyde, I mean, even if he remains as disturbed as he was at the time of these incidents, is going to mishandle the mail in the office in full view of his supervisors and coworkers. I mean, the analogy...
Are you saying you wouldn't be here if the order said that he's reinstated to his previous position?
No, even if the award said that, what I am in effect conceding is that under our contract and under postal regulations, the Postal Service is not locked into sending this man out on the street. There's more that can happen.
I mean, does the case turn on that?
I think that's one possible disposition. I think there's a lot more to the case, and I'll address that now. Let me begin by making the point that I think the case, as it's been defined in the briefs, is extraordinarily narrow. The Postal Service has conceded that it may employ persons who have been convicted of crimes, including persons who have committed crimes, in its phrase, against the mails. It concedes that it can employ persons who have had physical and mental disorders. And there's even a concession in the reply brief that the Postal Service can employ an individual with a history of compulsive gambling.
The Postal Service says it would have been illegal for them to retain this man on the payroll.
That's right. That is now the issue. The issue is that this is a special case, that Edward Hyde has been found to be so dangerous that to continue him in employment with the Postal Service is literally a violation of the Postal Service's duties under the Act. And we think this case can be disposed of on the basis of a very simple proposition. There has been no clear showing of the kind of explicit conflict between the Postal Service's duties under the statute and the requirements of the award, which is the kind of conflict that's required in MISCO. Let me begin with the Act. The relevant provisions of the Act consist initially of the mission-defining provisions, which are essentially sections 101 and 403. Those provisions tell the Postal Service, in effect, deliver the mail promptly and reliably and efficiently. Deliver the mail. The statute does not contain any provisions which specify who the Postal Service is to employ to deliver the mail. It doesn't specify any minimal qualifications, and it doesn't specify who the Postal Service must discharge, with a couple of very specific exceptions for striking and, in some instances, for unlawful political activity. The statute leaves those decisions to the discretion of the Postal Service with one obvious and highly significant qualification. The Postal Service must exercise its right to hire and discharge in a manner which is consistent with its collective bargaining agreements. The statute also provides that collective bargaining agreements may include provisions for resolution of adverse actions through binding third-party arbitration. Now, that's all the explicit language of the statute says on these issues. The actions of the parties and the arbitrator are completely consistent with this framework. The Postal Service and the union negotiated an agreement which preserves the Postal Service's authority to manage the Postal Service, to discipline, even discharge employees for offenses against the mail, with the one qualification which is provided for in the statute that any disputes over whether someone should be discharged are to be submitted to an arbitrator for binding resolution. That's what happened here. Hyde unquestionably committed a serious offense. We don't challenge that at all. But the union presented a very substantial case that there had been a material change in circumstances, that the dereliction of duty occurred during a period in which Hyde was suffering extreme emotional instability, and that he was now in therapy, and that
I thought the evidence showed that some of these pieces of mail found in his personal automobile had been there for a year. We're not talking about a one-day delay here. Oh,
that's true. I mean, I think it's undisputed.
This was an extended period of time, and we're not talking about junk mail.
Well, actually, for the most part, we are talking about junk mail. That's clear from the criminal case file, which we lodged with the court. Most of the mail apparently was junk mail that arrived during the Christmas rush. Hyde couldn't complete his route, put the mail in the trunk of his car, and his car was stolen. Now, obviously, he should have reported that. He never should have brought the mail back home. But what emerged in the criminal case, and what led ultimately to a very favorable report from the probation department and the sentence of probation, was that at this point, the gambling had taken over his life. That was the accepted fact. And that's consistent with what the literature reports about compulsive gambling, that it can lead to this kind of distraction and dereliction of responsibilities on the job. So that was the factual posture of the case. The arbitrator was then called upon to determine whether there was just cause for discharge. With the understanding that he could not foretell the future. Now, I recognize that the arbitrator said, I cannot foretell the future, and that there is a risk, but I would submit that if anything, those sentences, which I think are the foundation of the government's entire case, strengthen the argument for enforcing the award, because what they show is that this arbitrator recognized the problem and thought about it before he made his decision. And I think it's important to, if we're going to really focus on exactly what the arbitrator said, to emphasize that those sentences which establish that he cannot foretell the future occur essentially in the middle of the opinion, which consists of a general discussion of the evidence and the issue before him. The arbitrator's actual conclusions are on the last page of the award, and they consist of, first, a reference to another arbitrator's decision for the proposition that society must be prepared to take a small risk, a conclusion that Hyde's emotional problem did not render him unfit for further employment. And the ultimate conclusion was that he was not totally convinced that Hyde presently had the ability to perform in an acceptable manner. Now, that may be doubt, but I would respectfully submit that that's a very small doubt. And the arbitrator dealt with that doubt.
Mr. Secular, at page 22A of the award, of the arbitrator's opinion, says the arbitrator is not able to foretell what the future prospects of the grievance rehabilitation may yield. Now, that isn't saying there's just a tiny doubt in my mind. He's saying, I just don't know, as I read it.
That's right. He's saying, well, at this point, I think he's accepting as a given that no one can know for certain what the future would bring. I think a clear indication of how he looked at the specific facts of this case are found in what he said on page 23A. And I think the award in Samuel Bingham, which involved the dangers of reinstating an epileptic employee in a manufacturing situation, are important, because that's the analogy, as I see it, that the arbitrator found here. And the Cohn Award speaks in terms of very small risks because of the management options and the availability of treatment. That's the fairest construction
yes,
of this
but
award.
But here you do have a statute placing highest priority on the security of the mail and the prompt delivery, and that might mean that in the face of such an uncertain finding by the arbitrator, that this is one of those instances in which the judiciary can bring to bear its judgment.
Well, let me respond to that question, which I think goes to the heart of the case in this manner. If we had a crystal ball, which we could peer into, and we could see that if Hyde were placed back on the job, a significant amount of mail would be placed in the trunk of his car or otherwise mishandled, yes, this award would violate public policy. The problem is, obviously, we can't foretell the future, which is exactly what the arbitrator recognized. Because we're dealing with uncertainty, the question is whether the statute prohibits the employment of individuals who may be a greater risk than the average employee, or in this case, the next employee hired off the employment register. I don't think that statute creates any prohibition against the employment of high-risk employees. Now, it could be argued, I suppose, as a matter of policy, that that would be a good idea to prohibit the employment of high-risk employees in the Postal Service. But the fact is, Congress did not do that, and that's absolutely clear from the legislative history. Congress intended these matters to be decided by arbitrators. Now, frankly, I don't think that there is more mishandling of the mail now than there was before the Postal Reorganization Act, when the Postal Service had the authority to do exactly what it's seeking to do here, to walk away from an arbitration award on the ground that it's inconsistent with its statutory responsibilities. Prior to 1970, the old Post Office Department, pursuant to executive order, had the authority to conduct advisory arbitrations in its dealings with unions. But the department always retained the authority to overturn an award as for whatever reason it chose. And what Congress found, and this was after extensive studies of the Post Office Department, is that system didn't work. It led to extremely low morale, low productivity, tremendous frustration among the workers, which actually culminated in 1970 in a nationwide postal strike. That was the context in which Congress reorganized the Postal Service. I think it would be completely inconsistent with congressional intent to attribute to Congress a purpose which is not stated anywhere in the language of the statute to give either management or the courts the authority to, in effect, substitute their judgment for an arbitrator's, that the risks involved in reinstating an employee are too great.
Mr. Secretary, this public policy exception to the enforcement of arbitration awards has existed for a long time. You're not saying that it doesn't have any application in post office matters, are you?
No. We acknowledge that there is a public policy doctrine in the post office, but I think that touches on an important point which goes to the posture of this appeal. In MISCO, obviously, in the last footnote of the court's opinion, the court left open the question whether the public policy doctrine is limited, as the D.C. Circuit saw it, to violations of positive law. Now, the government has told us in its brief that that question, which was left open in the footnote, is not raised here, that the court doesn't have to look at it because it sees this case as involving nothing more than a violation of positive law. So, as I see this case, if there's no violation of the statute per se, that's the end of this appeal. There's no further inquiry into common law, any possible common law theory, because I don't see the government raising it.
Suppose the arbitrator said there was a high risk of recurrence.
That goes to how the statute is interpreted. I've suggested that even that statement would not be the basis for finding a conflict between the statute and the award. I'm prepared, in the limited time I have available.
But we interpret the statute, I take it?
That's right. And I'm, as a second position, I would grant that if an arbitrator made a finding like that, a public policy inquiry could be generated. Now, let me state before I go any further that if this arbitrator had made that finding, I don't see how, under our contract, the employee would have been reinstated. I think it's entirely unfair to assume that postal arbitrators exercising their functions under a statutory scheme are putting back to work people who they find pose a high risk to the security of the mail. That's not happening, and there's no reason for it to happen under a just cause provision. What should happen, ideally, if the Postal Service feels that someone has a psychological problem and his treatment is not sufficiently effective to reduce the risks of further misconduct, it should pose that question to the arbitrator. The regulations we've cited, which are used day-to-day in the Postal Service, permit the Postal Service to have an employee examined to generate psychiatric reports. The Postal Service knows how to build a case that an employee is unfit for further employment because of a psychological impairment. The union can contest that, and if the case is posed to the arbitrator that way, the arbitrator will make findings. One of the problems in this case is the Postal Service never really made that case here.
But you're saying that just cause will always be synonymous with the public policy?
I think it can be in the Postal Service.
That is up to the arbitrator, I take it?
The arbitrator won't interpret or doesn't have to say that just cause means that I will read the statute. But I think the factual inquiry, which is rather basic, whether an employee is going to mishandle the mail, is essentially the same. So it doesn't matter whether the arbitrator is deciding the case under a just cause standard or under a statutory standard. If there is a difference, and if it's the kind of difference which justifies overturning the award here, I'm afraid you're setting the threshold of risk so low that virtually any case involving misconduct can be brought into the courts for a second look. I mean, as I see it, what the Postal Service envisions is a bifurcated process whereby first the arbitrator plays the role of something akin to an insurance actuary and figures out what the statistical likelihood that this fellow will commit further misconduct is. And then management and then the courts pass judgment on whether that risk is acceptable.
You do have a plea of guilty to a criminal offense.
That's right. There's no question that looking at this case retrospectively, Hyde committed an offense involving the security of the mail. But I think it's important to point out that that statute, 18 U.S.C. 1703, which applies exclusively to employees and officers of the Postal Service, they're the only ones who can be convicted of that statute, doesn't provide for loss of employment as a sanction. So I think the answer to that point is exactly what then-Circuit Judge Marshall said in Otis Elevator in 1963, that the policy that is embodied in that criminal statute was vindicated in precisely the manner that Congress intended, by a criminal conviction and by the imposition of a criminal penalty.
Well, but that's the usual punishment that Congress provides for the violation of a criminal statute, either, you know, a term on probation or in prison or a fine. It doesn't usually go on to specify that if you're a federal employee and have done this, you lose your job. That's left to other authorities to decide.
Well, there are some statutes which do provide for loss of federal employment, and the Stryker example is one key example here. But obviously the answer to your question is yes. My only point was a limited one, that for purposes of a MISCO analysis, I don't think it's appropriate that to rely on the criminal statute here, because that policy and this award can't be said to be in conflict. That policy was wholly vindicated when
you could say the same about someone who's convicted of theft from the mails, that the policy of the statute prohibiting theft was fully vindicated when he was convicted, sent to prison for 2 years and fined $10,000. And yet I dare say the reaction of most courts would be quite different in that case to the one you suggest.
I think that the public policy I would suggest that the criminal statutes are not a basis for that kind of public policy inquiry. We do acknowledge that the Postal Reorganization Act is a basis for the inquiry, and I didn't read the government's brief as suggesting anything more than that. I the policy it's looking to, at least in the brief, is the policy that emanates from the Postal Reorganization Act itself. And the theory, as I stated before, is a limited theory that the Act imposes on management certain duties, and this award requires management to violate those duties.
Mr. Segula, the other side of the coin, there have been instances where people have been acquitted of a postal violation and still discharged from post office.
That's correct. That's correct. Because the obviously, the standard of proof under a criminal statute is higher, so that it would an arbitrator could decide that even if the proof did not rise to the level of that a man could be convicted under the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, there was still sufficient reason to discharge the employee. I'd like to respond now to certain specific contentions that the Postal Service advanced in its reply brief. One of the the government makes reference to cases which involve contracts which have been held to violate public policy because of their tendency to induce improper conduct. And that that perspective, I think, underlies the argument that enforcement of this award may encourage misconduct by Hyde's coworkers. I don't think that's a fair interpretation of the award or of the union's position. beginning of the award makes clear that the union acknowledged throughout that delay of the mail is improper, it is cause for discipline, and it could be the basis for discharge. The union's argument here was that there was a change in circumstances, a material change in circumstances, based on the fact that Hyde is now being treated. I don't see how, by any rational calculus, whatever benefits a reasonable employee might determine he would derive from delaying the mail, and I don't even know what they are, wouldn't be outweighed by the costs recognized by this award, which include criminal conviction, a suspension almost 1 year in length without pay, the possibility of discharge if he's unable to convince the arbitrator that there are grounds for reinstatement based on mitigating circumstances. In addition, I want to make the point that at this point, assert that the award may encourage others, may set a bad example for other employees, is, in Misko's language, sheer speculation, because there's been no evidence one way or another on that issue, none presented to the arbitrator and none presented to the court below. The reply brief also makes reference to the balancing test, which was enunciated as an element in a public policy inquiry. Just want to state the position that under Town of Newton v. Rummery, we would take the position that in any case involving the public policy doctrine, a balance of the interests at stake is appropriate and necessary. In this,
do I understand that you that you say that the public policy exception is limited as to the circumstances that the Court of Appeals stated?
I think that
the award must actually command illegal conduct?
I think that's the issue in this case, given the way it's been postured.
That is your standard for the public policy exception?
Yes, I would.
It has to command it. It wouldn't be enough if no reasonable person could believe other than that it would result in illegal conduct?
Yeah.
Give us a break.
Well,
to command illegal conduct?
No, I would. I used the crystal ball example before. I said if we could predict the future with certainty and we would know that enforcing this award would result in delay of the mail.
If a reasonable person would have to come to the conclusion that it would result in the violation of a statute, surely that would be enough, wouldn't it?
Yeah, but I
if that's the only conclusion a reasonable person could draw.
I would agree with that proposition in the abstract. I would suggest, though, that it's unrealistic that a discipline case is ever going to come before the court in that posture. I can envision work rule cases where the arbitrator commands management or the Postal Service to operate in a certain way, which is inconsistent with the statute. We gave a rather silly example in our brief. Suppose an arbitrator found that the entire Postal Service had to shut down in the summer months so that letter carriers could have a vacation. Well, that would be precisely the kind of hypothetical that
Well, don't you think the Court of Appeals has adopted in several cases the standard that there's no violation of public policy in enforcing an award unless the award orders illegal conduct?
Yes. I mean, the D.C. Circuit has taken the so-called narrow view, and I agree that there are other courts of appeals which have taken a broader look at the have adopted a broader formulation, and that this court has not resolved the issue. My only point is that
What if it isn't limited to commanding illegal conduct?
Well, I don't see how that the possibility of a theory based on the broader view of the public policy doctrine helps the government here. I agree with the government. This is not the case in which to address that issue, because the argument is, as I understand it, that compliance with this award would be a violation of management's statutory duties. So I see this case as requiring a finding of a direct conflict between the statute and the award.
May I ask you one last question? The award says at the end of the 6-day period, if it is shown that he has done these various things, to whom was that showing to be made? Do you understand? Who was to make the findings after 60 days?
Well, I assume it would be shown initially to management, and if there were a dispute, that would be resolved through the grievance procedure.
Go back to before the arbitrator.
That's right. I have nothing further.
Thank you, Mr. Sekulow. Mr. Nager, you have 1 minute remaining.
I'd like to use the minute to address three quick points. One, there's been a lot of discussion of junk mail. And let me stress that the reason why we've come to this court with this case is because the Postal Service feels that every piece of mail that is given to the Postal Service, that the Postal Service is obligated to deliver and safeguard against undue risks of non-delivery, that whether the mail is junk mail or whether it's AFD, you know, checks for AFDC benefits to unwed mothers, all of the mail is important from the Postal Service's perspective, and that what we're trying to do is ensure that it's delivered. Justice Scalia, I fumbled your question a little bit about how much risk. Let me try to readdress that. What we consider to be an undue risk is an employee who there's a finding made is a significantly greater risk than the average employee. That the average employee is not one who we have any indicia to know other than just systematic risk. Someone may commit misconduct. But here we had identified for us by an arbitrator.
Thank you, Mr. Nager. Your time has expired. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next.